This week on A to Z Running, we continue examining wise decisions, this time looking at conscious awareness and the dangers of outside influence on our decision making.
We answer a listener question about running hills in preparation for a hilly race.
In the world of running, Arcadia is swiftly becoming the high school distance running mecca.
The U.S. 10-mile championships was a record-breaking thriller.
And from the headlines, being cold has a much bigger effect on endurance performance, a recent study shows.
All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I'm Zach, and welcome back yourself.
Thank you, Andy.
Welcome back. And you can learn everything you need to know about all the things that we talk about and do at atozrunning.com. Follow us on Instagram. You can find us as well on YouTube and Spotify, where our content goes the most.
The most?
The most. Uh-huh. And interact and do the things. It's lots of fun. And speaking of lots of fun, hills are a topic of conversation today. And it just so happens, it's coincidental. Has nothing to do with our intent by any means. But a great many people seem to be talking about hills right now. And we like it when people talk about them favorably. In fact, a recent conversation with Marjorie, runner and listener, and Marjorie specifically said, and I am directly quoting her, hills are my favorite.
That's amazing.
She likes hill workouts better than all the others. And I just had to share that because that I don't think is a very common sentiment in running in general, but I think that's good. I think that's just wonderful. Hills are a blast and challenging, but in all the good ways.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you like hills, you should let us know because we're going to spend a bit of time talking about them, as it were, today anyway.
Yeah, very cool. Well, Zach had mentioned that I was gone. I'm back. I was in Minneapolis. And this is a super interesting thing, at least to me. And of course, my experiences of one. But when I was running in Minneapolis, so many runners were smiling. They were smiling.
Wow. And I'm so glad to
hear
that.
They did not only like greet me, but there was more smiling runners. And then I started thinking, is this because Dakota Lindworm lives in Minneapolis?
Dakota Lindworm cannot single-handedly make the running culture in a big city positive.
She does speak about it a lot, and it has been brought to people's attention. So I wonder if like the whole science of smiling is really really taken root in Minneapolis. Or the people are just what they call Midwest nice. I guess that's a thing.
Is Minneapolis Midwest?
Yeah. I got a mug right here.
It's kind of right on the outside.
That says Midwest nice. I got it in Minneapolis.
Okay. Well, that's something. Social contagion is real. So I guess the smiles are making more smiles.
It was pretty cool. And then it was also great because I got to see Dakota. But we're going to get to that interview sometime in the near future. So stay tuned. Subscribe to the show.
You got to know that good things are coming. Mm-hmm. Speaking of good things, let's get on to your questions. Be sure to ask your questions by sending an email to questions@atozrunning.com, because how else are you going to get all your questions answered? No questions get answered unless you ask them.
Of someone. It doesn't have to be us, but we're glad for your questions and the conversations we can have here on the show. And thanks this week to Liv, who asked the question about hills. Yes. She wrote this message: "Hi, Andy and Zach. Love the podcast, and I've adopted many of your training principles over the time I started listening."
Many, but not all of them. I'm very curious which ones you don't like as much, Liv.
"I am planning to run a half marathon in about 3 weeks that is billed as one of the most difficult courses on the East Coast because of elevation changes, the Blue Ridge half, for those of you who are familiar. This is not my goal race. I am running this mostly for sentimental reasons with family members and such that will be running. And Liv's goal is actually a flattish marathon in June.
Okay.
Over February and March, she has built a great base and added steady runs. And her question is this, after that context, which we love. living in a place with very little elevation change, during which runs should I prioritize going to the few hills that are around to prepare for this half? The hills near me are not very convenient, but reasonable to do 1 to 2 times a week. Should I try to go there on steady runs, fartleks, long runs? Unfortunately, it's not feasible more than 1 to 2 days a week to go to these hills. Would love your thoughts.
Okay. When is the race? In a couple of weeks?
This isn't her goal race, right, but yes. It's a, yeah, 3 weeks.
Thanks for asking, Liv.
Yes, thanks,
we appreciate
Liv.
The question. And just in reflection here, that the goal of how can I, as a runner, do all of the things, you know, best, be prepared for the race, build myself appropriately, and you're talking about like having established good base and those kinds of things. You're thinking a lot about what you need to do well here. And I'm not suggesting that our answers are always the thing you need to do well. I mean, they are, but the point being, we appreciate the thoughtfulness to which you are approaching this endeavor. Even in this instance, a race you say it's not your goal race, but you still want to be prepared for it. That's great. Props to you.
Yeah. So 3 weeks is kind of a difficult amount of time before a race to be able to get a good stimulus in order to get the good adaptations to benefit you, especially when it's something new like hills, if you're predominantly running on flat surfaces. But because your goal race is in June, I still don't think it's a bad idea to perhaps start integrating hills into your running.
Yeah, so I guess it probably is true then that you're not likely to reap the benefits in time for that race. You kind of have two layers to this, I suppose, is the way we would think about it. Anytime you talk about a training stimulus, you have the what is this doing for my physiology and preparing my body in some capacity, and what is this doing for my like mental preparation, fortitude, and some of that kind of dynamic. So that's where we talk a lot about, like, there's some things that we do in training that aren't necessarily going to further our fitness, but we need to still be ready for those things when it comes to race day. And so that includes, like, you know, trying to have similar kinds of conditions, like course conditions, like you're describing here, doing a bit of time that replicates that. That includes things like trialing your race day approach, gear, strategy, fueling, all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, in this situation, it's probably true that you can't really see physiological benefits in time. We would say in any case, it takes 2 to 4 weeks to see strength-related physiological benefits, longer for energy system-related and shorter for certain things like neuromuscular. But for hill work in particular, what you're accomplishing by hill work in terms of physiological gain is you're increasing upper leg strength, you're increasing maximum muscle contraction, some of those types of dynamics, which you just don't do as well on flat ground. But that you won't see much benefit in time. But the neurological and neuromuscular side of this could help, meaning certainly just being comfortable running on hills. And so, you know, it's a bit of a shock to our system sometimes when we run like big hills when we're not used to that. So trying to spend some time on hills just so that it's more familiar, even just the sense of like you have to lift your legs differently when you run up a hill than when you run on flat ground, and having that be a familiar neuromuscular interaction for your body could help. And you could gain that benefit just doing it once. I mean, it's not as much a benefit as if you did it 4 or 5 times. Which is, sounds like you've got about enough time to do that 4 or 5 times before this race. But I also wouldn't do it too soon before the race or too near to the race, because then you're likely to fatigue some of those things without enough time for them to amply recover. Going back to our previous point, you're not going to get much physiological gain from this. So it's going to tire you out more than a regular hard effort would that you're doing right now, or it's likely to. So take care with it. But yeah, you could see some kind of benefits.
And you will see benefits, like if you continue on adding hills into your regimen before your June race, you will see benefits from it, even on a flat course, because it increases your economy and strength.
That was, yep. Thank you for reminding me of
that. Yeah, because the June race is the ultimate race. So I say it's not a bad idea, Liv, to add a few in. Now she's wondering on which runs.
Yeah.
So you could do it during your long and your steady. If you want to do hill-oriented work and more for economy, we have, I'd say do long hills, like 5 minute hills.
What kind of hills do you have access to here is the big question.
Well, that's true. You know? Like, it depends on what you have available to you.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got a mile long hill that you can run up and do like 3/4 of the way up and repeat fashion, that's not a bad idea here. You're not going like all out hill repeats. Like, these aren't hill sprints or anything, but yeah, to Andy's point, essentially a kind of fartlek is not a bad idea. If you don't have access to a singular hill in that sense that accomplishes that goal, but like a nice hilly road, for instance, that's where you might do something like just a, you know, in your regular fartleks, use the uphills as the harder efforts and sometimes the downhills, because you need to be able to run downhill efficiently also if you're on a hilly race course, which sometimes is even more painful than running uphill for runners. Yeah. So
it is good to be careful, though, with all these things. You know, if there's any niggles or anything that you have previously injured that you know could be vulnerable, these are things to be careful with. So just putting that out there, that definitely do your first time on a new stimulus, really gauge that. The effort should be less than what you really want to give. And keep that monitor raised.
But as these things go, hills are easier on your musculoskeletal structure in terms of running uphill, but they're harder on the soft tissues. So like if you have an Achilles problem, for instance, the hills are very dangerous. But if you have like an aching shin, like shin splints or something, it's actually a little bit easier on them than running on flat ground, especially hard. I mean, running hard on flat ground, but the downhill part can be painful also. So great,
stopping
great
motion.
Care. And all of these things amount to live in a situation where I have a hilly race and I want to be ready for it. If I don't have enough time, we're talking 2 to 4 weeks minimum to run regular hill workouts once or twice a week. If I can't do that ahead of the race, then at least I can run a few hilly somethings that just simply prepare me for the experience of trying to run harder efforts, higher efforts on hills. Not that they have to always even be harder efforts. You could do an easy run on hills and it still helps with those kinds of things. I would not do a long run that's especially hilly though, because that's probably just a little too much unless you're familiar, like you've been doing hilly things regularly.
So, but best, she's asking which would be best, and it's the long, steady effort hills.
Yeah, like repeats. Yep. Mm-hmm. Long, steady repeats or the fartlek kind of dynamic on hills. Yep.
That's such a great question, Liv. Thank you so much for asking it, and good luck to you in your goal race in June, but I hope that you have so much fun with your family at this really hilly, challenging course that you have coming up real soon.
Sounds like a blast. Mm-hmm. Thanks again. Now, let's get on to something else helpful. So, who did your homework before this episode? Anyone who listened to last week's episode and did not do your assignment? Shame on you.
No shame here.
No, I just, yes, shame.
No, none.
All of it.
No shame.
Lots. But this is what we did last week. I need to recap this, because if you didn't listen to last week, then you're like, what is he talking about? It's annoying, Zach. So we have started a series. We're going to do 3 weeks. So we'll end it next week with the final episode here. But the series on the book by Lohr and Olson Walker, Wise Decisions. Got it right here. Wise Decisions. And so their claim, this is what I said last week, their claim is bold, which is that they're going to teach you wisdom. That's always a bold claim, and that it's science-based. And so another bold claim. So they've got the two-pronged boldness here going on. And so I just wanted to dig into it a bit and see, you know, what can we glean from their work on the topic. And last week we kicked it off by talking about what they call reality-distorting mechanisms. In other words, the ways we lie to ourselves. And that's fundamentally where you need to start with this kind of thing, because the reason we tend to be unwise as we make decisions has a lot to do with how we deceive ourselves as we're thinking about the decisions, or not thinking at all, which is a different part of the problem. So just a quick recap of that. We shared things like confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, which are the types of things that basically say my brain wants the outcome that fulfills my desires in the situation. And so if I want a thing here, I'm more likely to see that thing or see it as the wise thing or something of that nature. So there's a lot behind that. We talked about it last week. Go back, listen to the episode if you want to really dig into it deeply. I think what it comes down to is that twofold. Remember, the key here is that making decisions takes energy, and following through with those decisions takes even more energy. And our brains have this kind of default wiring of path of least resistance kind of thing. The human psyche always wants the easiest thing, not always consciously, although consciously is generally true as well. So,
except for some of you who decide to do really hard things, like, you know, run marathons, half marathons, 5Ks.
Isn't that the Goggins? Runs. Isn't that the Goggins thing? Do hard things. Yeah, but that's actually an invaluable reflection. We know that part of that kind of thinking is it comes from this sense of like, I have a core value here that is more important than that default wiring. And we can create in ourselves a kind of pattern that replicates that. And that's what we're really trying to get at here and why we wanted to dive into this work, because there's some really good, good suggestions here. Yeah. Good insights in the work that help us get to that. So here is your homework last week. If you missed it, shame on you. And
no shame.
And your homework was to inventory your inner voice for a few days, 3 to 5 days. And what we mean by that is like, how am I talking to myself about things day to day? Sure. But we really were saying focus on like the running stuff, because that's kind of our angle with this content specifically. And it's kind of tedious and labor intensive to try to inventory your inner voice all day long every day. So I figure it's much easier if we just say, okay, when I'm thinking about the running decisions and what to do today or when to do it or whether to do it, depending on weather and other things. So I hope you did that. We're going to reflect briefly. I'm putting Andy on the spot here.
Sure.
We're going to reflect briefly on our own inner voices and some of the influences there as a context for we start to get into how we deal with the interplay between our inner voice and our self-coaching and our core beliefs, fundamental inside ourselves and some of that kind of stuff. So let's start very briefly. Last week, just so you know, in the places where I was running, it was pretty cold and rainy almost the entire week. Like, awful. And it's the kind of thing like, you know, mid 40s down to a high 30s and rainy. So the rain is close to ice, but not quite frozen, which means it just chills you to your bone in moments. And that was the nature of it. Now, what was Zach's inner voice doing? What was I saying to myself during all these times? And really what's interesting here, and it's neither a judgment of one thing or another or a boast of one thing or another, but my inner voice didn't really have much to say except for trying to run when it was the least bad out. And so it was less about like, I don't know if I really want to do this, or, you know, there was a day or two where I was on the treadmill, but it wasn't because of the weather, it was because of other like circumstances with kids and stuff and needing to be on the treadmill. But as it were, the thing that I was kind of dealing with was more around the lines of like the things that influence the run outside of the run. So like when I was eating or not eating, or what I was eating or not eating. And it would be something like, I really should eat right now because I'm hungry and I don't know exactly when I'm going to run yet. But then I would say like, well, but if I run soon, then I'm going to like be full in my gut. And so maybe I should eat less, but then I delayed the run. And so it was like one of these things where I just was not,
This is really boring self-talk.
That's the point. But I was letting the circumstances just kind of happen and I was not being very deliberate. And so as such, there were a number of situations last week where like I was crunched for time. I did not run. I wasn't proactive enough. And so I either had to cut a run shorter than I wanted to, or I didn't do specifically the thing that I meant to do that day and had to switch it with another day because of timing. So that's kind of not generally the greatest look on a disciplined runner's week in general. How about you, Andy?
So I didn't run very much this week.
Well, yes.
So I guess I can give you some thoughts that I've had, though, on my self-talk.
Yeah, that's good.
I have ADHD, and so I realize that in my self-talk, I'm often telling myself what I am doing or reminding myself what I am doing. So, like, why did I come? What am I doing right now? Like, why did I come in this room? You're brushing your teeth, Andy. You're, I'm like telling myself what I'm doing. I'm like self-narrating, but also like coaching myself.
Interesting. Okay. So,
but with running, so yeah, I did have a couple, I guess I did have a couple runs. But I admittedly was listening to a podcast during one of them. So I didn't have a lot of self-talk in that one. The other one, I was kind of like, this is just, I'm being honest here. I just felt terrible. Like my body felt really bad. So I kept asking myself, like, why do I feel bad? Like, what can I do to try to feel better? If I slow down, will I feel better? And then I slowed down, I wasn't feeling better. And I'm like, should I be running at all? So anyway, that's kind of the self-talk that I had. But I do ask myself a lot of questions. And I think that oftentimes the questions are not a bad thing because I do then try to evaluate things. But yeah.
So one of the interesting caveats here in self-talk is that there are basically two forms of self-talk. The one is the personal pronouns, like I. And so I talk to myself like, I really should do this right now, or I don't know if I want to, like things like that. And then it's the you, where you now talk to yourself like someone else. You really need to do this right now. You can do it. You've got it. Like all that kind of stuff. I'm curious for you, Andy, how much of it is one versus the other, or are you not even aware?
Oh, I'm aware. I can't say, like, this isn't a really good week to talk
about.
No,
but I just mean in general.
In general, like, when I am running races, I say a lot of you. And even, like, silly stuff like, you can do it, Andy. Like, I'll even, like, put my name in there. Yeah, so a lot of times when I'm, like, coaching myself, so to speak, the inner coach, I will say you. And that's often during harder efforts and during races.
So sports psychology 101, or maybe 201, depending on how deep into the thing is, it tends to be the case, it's advisable that when it comes to that type of like motivation and inspiring mantra type of dynamic, that it's better to make it second person and you talk to yourself as if you are another person. On the one side, because we are more capable of objective reasoning when we are talking to ourselves like we're giving someone else advice. But also, it tends to have greater, what would be the right word here? It motivates us more in that sense than the personal, like, I can do this, you can do this, motivates us more than I can do this. And in general, there's lots of individual differences and nuances, no doubt. But point is, that's fascinating. Part of why I wonder that is because that is in fact relevant to part of what we're going to talk about here. And we're curious, as you then have reflected on some of these things for yourselves, those listening, where some of that kind of tends to fall. What we want to address here in terms of the big question and why that homework fits now, we'll tie some of that together here at the end more. But we want to get to the big question, kind of like of all of it, really, in the author's work, which is... the inner core sense, like my core beliefs, my core self, what is influencing that? And where does all that inner voice stuff come from? And how ultimately can these things interact with like my decision making? And so the inner core, then, if we were to talk about that as a fundamental concept now for this topic, that's like the, you know, the values, the core values, the core beliefs, my sense of self, my personal credo. What is the right word?
Creed.
My personal creed.
Kind of like the word credo, though.
I don't know what credo is a thing, though. Anyway, so all of that is like, that's what we mean when we start, the authors mean when they talk about inner core. And so we're going to try to dig into that a little bit here, in particular, talk about some of those influences. But before we do, we got to set the stage with just a crazy, crazy story. Not really a story as much as it's a situation that has been studied. So I'm gonna go directly to the scenario in the book. This comes from chapter 18 of, in case anyone's following along, of the book. And they call this the Goldman Dilemma. And so some of you may be familiar with this. As soon as I say that, you're like, oh, I actually know what you're talking about. Because it comes up a lot, in specifically in sports situations, because that's where it was studied. But here's what it is. You basically have to then apply this scenario. And the question is, what would you do given this situation? All right. So be thinking for yourself. Now, first, you got to put yourself into the role of, you are an elite competitive athlete. That's necessary because that's the nature of what they looked at when they were studying this. So imagine that you have been training since you were 7 years old, all the stuff. But you've sacrificed everything, and you're not really looking like you're going to achieve all of your dreams. It's become more of an obsession, more like an obsession, but not really sure that you can get across the line, right? All the way. So then at that moment in time, you're doubting, denying, or unsure. A close friend of the family happens to be a brilliant molecular scientist. Remember, this is just the scenario. And presents you with an intriguing proposition. According to him, he has broken the biochemical code for achieving nearly unlimited athletic success. All right. So he's figured it out. He's going to say, all your dreams will come true. You will never lose again. He's got the thing that will make it so this is, okay, you have to assume that this is possible, okay? Otherwise, the situation doesn't work. But if it were possible, he's figured it out. But here's what you got to do. You have to take a pill, and everything will be yours, all your dreams. But you have to know that, yes, the pill is banned, and it is definitely against the rules. But it will never be detected because he's amazing, this person. So no one will ever bust you for it. So you'll get away with it, okay? But it is against the rule. You'll get away with it for all of time. No one will ever find out that you cheated. But finally, one other but, you will die in 5 years. Okay, that's the situation. You got to cheat. You will die in 5 years. No one will ever know, but you will get everything. All your hopes and dreams will come true. Andy, would you take the pill?
No. Huh. It's not even like a thought for me, because, and the reason for this, two things. One, it sounds so unsatisfying to like win but cheat, because then you know you weren't really the winner. And then the second part is you die in 5 years. Like, there's so many other things to life than athletic endeavors.
So, Andy, you're thinking the same thing the authors say most people respond to when they hear this situation, right? Sounds completely absurd. No one would actually make that choice, right? No one. Except when they study this, now this is where the specific situation referred to as the Goldman Dilemma, they give this survey routinely. And over the course of 200 high-level athletes each year, they find that half will take the pill. Half. Dead in 5 years, breaking the rules and cheating, and you full well know it, but all your hopes and dreams come true. How is that possible? And what it comes down to, as the authors examine that and reflect with us here together, is that we are capable of making terrible decisions that do not align with what we truly desire in life, our core values and beliefs. And we can just do it, just like that. So the reflection here, as we want to try to dive into it, is what are we telling ourselves, and what information is coming into us from the outside that is influencing that self-talk, as well as then the inner core side of things? And the authors dig into this really in depth when they call this concept the gatekeeper, your inner core gatekeeper. And in particular, that it is very easy for things to override our discernment, our internal discernment, making us make decisions contrary to what we truly hold as our core values, our desires out of life, the thing that we want to achieve, or want to, our personal creed, what we want to define ourselves, right? It's very easy. Case in point, the authors give a number of examples, but one of them is the marketing and sales industry. In particular, that industry is based on the expertise of overriding our discernment. Fundamentally, that's the point. That is the purpose of sales, is to make us do something we may not have otherwise wanted to do.
And the way that they do that in so many ways, but one of them is using credible people. So like, you know, celebrities. So that would be more like how we feel about someone personally. Or they will even have someone in a lab coat who's not actually a doctor who will like say something, but that is going to help you believe it more. They're your friends, like ambassadors for things. You know, we take our friends' opinion more. So they're going through, you know, social media marketing and Instagram. And so it wants to get closer and closer to like where you let down your guard, so to speak. So, and then that allows for the marketing to work better because we're like, oh, well, it's a friend, or I'm on Instagram where I'm like, or communicating with friends.
So in education, we tend to call this the belonging belief. And this is a positive thing. We want people to feel a sense of belonging, in particular students in a classroom, right? That we find that academic gains are substantially higher in an environment where you feel a sense of belonging. And one of the things that's often said to achieve that end is I, the student, want to see people who think like me, look like me, act like me, caring about a thing. And then I'm more likely to care about it, right? And so we try to create opportunities for such a thing. But in fact, that's the point. As Andy's like saying, like, they call these truth traps. And we wanted to talk about a few of them here because just briefly. But when you start to read through a list like this, you're like, oh my goodness, this is like that. Yeah, they're doing all of this stuff in so many ways. And they, I mean, like all of these kinds of industries that are trying to get us to do something. That's it. They want to get us to do something. And sometimes it's make a purchase. Sometimes it's take some kind of action that's not exactly a purchase, but what is that something? So these truth traps are just pretty obvious and straightforward things. Like, because it feels true, it must be true. So if I can create a sentiment that you agree with, like that feels right, well, then it must be true.
Or like it's a sentiment that is agreeable for most and it is true, but it's associated with a brand. So it's like, yeah, that brand said that thing that I agree with, but has nothing to do with their product. But you're more likely to buy their product now that you agreed with them on a sentiment because it feels good, feels true. Does that make sense?
Yeah, think about how much effort goes into just creating a feeling in like advertising and such. And they know, like you can watch an entire commercial about something and have no idea what the product is, right? All they're doing in that whole commercial is creating a feeling. And then at the end, they just show their logo. And what they're doing is associating that feeling with that logo. And they'll do that. If they can hit you with that over and over and over, then you inherently begin to believe the positive things. It's not a coherent belief. It's just a sense. But because it feels true, it must be true. Becomes the kind of thing.
And then the one that I had mentioned about like your friends and things, it says, because my closest, most respected friends believe it, it must be true. Mm-hmm. And it must be so.
Or in a similar sense, because when I demonstrate a belief and it is a positive impression for other people, like it looks good, then that must make it more true.
Like if it makes me like look smarter or it makes people like me more.
Let's talk about Strava for a second, people. If doing the thing looks more like I'm training hard or doing good training, I'm more likely to want to do that thing, even if it may entirely be not true. Okay, well, so there's a lot of these, and we're not going to go through and read the whole entire list, but the one other one that I wanted to note here briefly is that so this idea of like I know myself, I know my motivations and such, and so because I know that my motivations are good, then I think that my sense of what is true is more right than other people's. So we judge ourselves by our motives and we judge others by their actions. That's the whole principle. And I don't remember who said that. I was just talking with someone about this recently. That is not my quote. That is not these authors. But anyway, there's a lot there to unpack. What we're trying to say is that it is very easy to override, for external things to override our inner voice and get into, as the authors say, our inner core. And we need to stop letting so many things into our inner core that shouldn't be there in particular. But even if they should be there, we should take greater care.
Which takes energy.
And that is part of the point. So it, in fact, costs, this is really kind of just obvious, but we need to dwell on it. It takes more energy to disagree with something or disprove something than it does to simply agree, right? It takes more energy to disagree. And so, as you know, there are certainly many people out there who just love disagreeing. Plenty of cynics in the world. Andy just pointed at someone in the room, and it wasn't her. But what it comes down to is that even in that sense, it still costs energy. But for some people, it costs even more energy than others. And what it comes down to for all of us in that sense, how do we manage that energy? Now, we're not actually going to answer that question this week. That's the last episode. That's the core major takeaway we have to figure out is managing energy and emotion with our inner voices. But as it were, what we have to think about here is at a minimum, we need to protect that inner core, our discerning, gatekeeping sense of what's getting into our internal self. We need to take greater care with that. And the authors have some suggestions there. I think it's interesting to reflect on them.
Yeah. Assume that data is coming to you with some sort of bias.
So that's everything is biased. And it's a fascinating, I've not understood fully the current contemporary reflection on the concept of bias, because bias is a guarantee. It is an assurance where humans are involved. And arguably, and this is actually something I was encountering recently, I thought it was kind of funny, and I was trying to really understand what they were saying about it. But because technology, like artificial intelligence or those kinds of things, because those are built by humans, they still have bias because human bias went into the construction of it. And someone was saying that, and I was like, I never thought about that. But the context, this is actually, I'm going to say it because it's really funny. And some of you will just find this to be interesting and go look it up now. There's actually no way to create true randomness. It's not possible for a human to produce something that is truly random. So like you can take a computer generated formula, right? And find a way to make it randomize something. But because it has the human touch, it is not perfectly truly
random. Can it just be like math though? Isn't there just math that makes it random?
That's what I'm saying. It's not perfectly random because you have to somehow connect something to something else to generate that randomness.
That's beyond me.
Anyway, I don't know. So again, this is the claim that the person was making. I find it fascinating. I don't know that I have a strong sense of it to be able to dissect it. But either way, bias is ever present. And we should not be concerned about that. In the concept, we should be concerned about what are the biases of the things coming at me and assume that there are and then be able to evaluate or address that.
I think it's interesting. I'm going to take a small side step to the side with this. I think that when we are able to assume bias, even our own bias, we can have better communication with other people and mm-hmm. ourselves.
Inner voice talk, self-talk.
Self-talk, but also that you're – right. When you're talking to others. So if you say – if you're having a conversation about something that is, you know, sensitive and you're like, hey, and you're asked for advice to even say and hedge it by, like, I only come from my own experience and this is how I am biased. This has been my experience. Like, the person can hear you without feeling like if they have experienced something different that you're – that you're saying how something needs to be, or it's a very interesting thing if you are able to take that as a form of humility too. Like, I don't know it all. I am biased. This is what my experience has been.
It's also a given though, and that's part of the challenge. Like, it's a redundancy to say I'm only saying this from my own experience.
But I think
that's the
only
place you can start any comment.
It's true. It's from that my is own already true. But I think that it's helpful.
It's like saying I think before you say something. Like, well, yeah, that's the assumption.
But it's part of a kindness and communication as well. You, yeah. But then that's too, like, thinking when something happens to you, again, like if you feel like something happens to you or someone has hurt you and you come from a place of, like, compassion because, like, something probably happened to that person and it riled them up and they responded this way, like, towards you that was hurtful, even if you weren't part of the previous thing that bothered them. Like, you know, to be able to think, like, everyone is coming from a state that I might not know everything about. So that's my little sidestep, because I think that being able to come, like, assume that when you have information coming at you, that there are things that you don't know.
Yeah, well, and fundamentally, if we were to change the phraseology here, to just make it something I think even simpler, is I don't know the motivations of the thing or the person that is informing me of something, unless I do, right? Which you may, that there may be context where, like Andy said, someone may tell you their motivations. Like us, for instance, right now on A to Z Running, our motivations as we talk about running here are fundamentally not to make you a better runner. Although we think you will be a better runner by implementing the kinds of things that we're talking about. Fundamentally, our motivations are to try to help runners thrive in and out of the sport as we're pursuing it. And we think that there are things that influence that, like what we're talking about right now, that aren't exactly like just, you know, better training and higher quality workouts, which, you know, so as
it
were.
We talk about a lot, but yeah. This is going to be something that's also beneficial.
Yeah. And then in that, from that angle, we could further state, like, there are certain things that have then influenced our current thinking and certain other things that have not as heavily. And so you could say, well, when Zach and Andy start talking about running and they start giving some suggestions, it's evident that there are certain influences present there. Yes, there are. We actually try to tell you what those influences are as much as we are aware of them. But even then, there's a whole lot more going on here than just we read this book and that's where this idea came from. And so you have to take care with this. And I guess this is actually a cautionary note. I was going to wait until a little bit later to say this, but we cannot be a cynical people. That is a very unhealthy thing. What I mean by that is we need to be a people who can trust each other, trust certain things, sources and such. We need to be that, because when we aren't, it is a very unhealthy society. That's my personal judgment. Also seems to be evident when you observe just in microcosms things where we can trust each other. And then what that trust comes from is not that I trust that you're always perfect and true and right about everything you say all the time, but rather, can we trust our motivations and can we trust the good that we are pursuing together?
Well, and that's going to vary from person to person in your life. So there might not be everybody.
Right.
That you
but that's what I'm saying is there's a balance. Access, you need to, the authors here say, stay discerning at all times. But we also need to be careful that we're not becoming cynical in that discernment. That's what I'm trying to suggest. There's a place here in the middle that says, how do I weigh carefully all the things around me as they're coming into me and weigh what I allow into my inner core, as the authors say, without being a cynic and hypercritical about everything around me. And that the authors don't give a good way to find that balance, partly because I don't know that they're not really leaning in the direction of this might be the result. But in the fact, it is. When you're trying to be discerning, you may tend towards cynicism. So we want to caution you. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, there's other guidelines here that kind of swirl around the same principle. But I think that just, you know, when it comes to just being productive in the way we're examining the ideas that are coming at us from our own self-talk or from externally, is that just recognizing that these things are imperfect is the best way to summarize it. Mm-hmm. They're incomplete, they're biased, their motivations are unclear. It is imperfect. And as such, we have to make a decision knowing that imperfection. So that's kind of the, like, how do we layer this a little bit?
I think the hardest thing to do is to discern what we tell ourselves. Because I will be the first one to admit that the hardest things come from the inner talk. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that in running, especially when we get ourselves to those vulnerable spots, which we do, hey, we're kind of known for that. When we put ourselves to the limit physically, and especially in the long races, you become so fatigued that it's hard to continue to have good, what do you call, barriers to our inner core self. Yeah. And so I think that it's really helpful to continue to practice these things when, you know, when things aren't so hard as in the last 10K of a marathon, so that when we get to that, we can have good self-talk.
So what it comes down to, I mean, this is it's a very simple application. What Andy's saying here, and the principle that has guided our general recommendation for some years now. I don't know exactly where this originally came from either. You know, speaking of motivations, but at one point or another, Andy and I started saying, as we're talking with runners, and then certainly on the show as well, really every decision needs to start with, what are my goals and what do I need? And that's the, for the runner, that's the core, right? That's my core self, my values in terms of like my personal creed, and the things that are important. What are my goals? What do I want out of this thing? And what do I need? And within that, everything that I decide as a runner should be fundamentally toward best achieving those dynamics, my current need to arrive at my ultimate goal. And that's, the authors call it conscious awareness or reflective consciousness. There's a couple layers to this, but the conscious awareness, being aware of what's going on and how it's influencing that, and being able to have that pause of thinking about, before something gets in, before I'm making a decision based on some information or some idea, ask that question and somehow filter that in a similar sense. That's kind of it. I mean, that's the big, we got to make sure as we're thinking about the reality of this thing, that it's not that complicated. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty simple fact.
Couple things with self-talk, because I know you guys love tangible takeaways. What things can I do starting today to help me? So using, like Zach had mentioned, the you type coaching statements to yourself and have them be positive. Don't speak to yourself differently than you would speak to your 8-year-old kid, you know, just because because you're more hard on yourself is what I'm saying. I saw you give me a smirk on that. But like, if you're going
to
be kind.
Sometimes I have a tendency to.
You're kind to others. Okay, be kind to yourself is what I'm saying. And actually saying things out loud is helpful. It is.
Yep.
And the more you repeat these things, the more you believe them.
Yep.
Lies too. So be careful. So continue to tell yourself those good, true things that you want as part of your inner core. And those things actually help you in the times when you're more vulnerable or uncertain.
So more on that, because that's where we're going next week. You definitely want to stick around, because that's when we really talk about what does it take to then manage the energy, emotion, and stress of all of this decision-making dynamic. That's the big promise, right? Is it possible? Yes. And here's how. But we have some homework for you, as always, because...
As always? Not always.
And on this topic.
Okay.
Well, I mean, always is only twice so far. But anyway, so here's your assignment. And now this is simple, because you've already done the first part of the assignment. Remember I said you have to do it. Or it doesn't help if you do it late, because now at this point, you can't do both assignments at the same time.
Yes, you can. You can always be managing and taking inventory of your self-talk.
Well, anyway, so take now a separate list. Write out a list of your core values, like the personal creed, the core beliefs about the thing. And so if it's specific to running, that's fine. If you want to do this like life in general, that's up to you. But what are those core things that define what is most important to you, about you, within this thing? And write them out. Maybe it's one or two, maybe it's a little bit longer list. And then look at that inner voice inventory that you took. Or if you haven't done that yet, then do this now side by side. And what we're looking for here is comparisons. Where do these things align? Where do they not? Are there any conflicts between the decisions I'm making or the inner voice things I'm telling myself and my core here? And then the final optional step, of course, is if there are misalignments or conflicts, why do you think that is? Like, where do you feel like that might be coming from? If you skip that step, fine. But the point is, next week, we're actually going to then talk about how we can use this thing to achieve the desired end, which is managing our energy, emotion, and stress.
All right. Well, I feel challenged. I'm going to take this homework to heart, Zach.
Good.
And I just really I've enjoyed this conversation so far, and I want to challenge all of you to do some really good self-talk this week as well. So in addition to Zach's homework, my little addition to that, my little extra credit is to think about how you're talking to yourself and be intentional about it. Good. Now let's get on to the world of running. Starting with some A to Z runner shout outs, starting with Erin, who is second in her age group at the Bentonville Half Marathon. But not only that, it's her first race back from hip surgery. I'm just so proud of her. I'm just so excited. Things are looking great, and very excited she was able to celebrate that first race back and do it so well.
And that emphasis on the so well, not just that, you know, it was a positive result having gone well, but also well executed, starting very much within herself. You know, you're coming off of a hip surgery 6 months later, and you got to be careful here. And doing so very successfully, managing that well.
Yeah.
Nice job, Erin.
Mm-hmm. And as many of you know, Marathon Monday is soon approaching, and there is quite the crew of A to Z runners who are going to participate, even more that qualified. So they all, I want to give them a shout out as well, but
for various reasons may not be able to participate or may have chosen not to this year, but
yeah. So who will be running Boston, Zach?
Dano, Hannah, Julie, Kendra, Mark, Spencer, and Steph, among
and then a couple who had
couple
to have
possibilities,
depending on health. Yep.
So congrats to everyone who has qualified and is going to be in Boston for that big one. It's always an exciting thing. And we wish you the best. It sounds like it's supposed to be a little bit better experience than some of the bad weather ones in the recent past. But all told, we hope that it goes well for you.
Mm-hmm. We're going to start with high schoolers.
Holy smokes.
You're why do Andy and Zach talk about high schoolers so much? It's because they are the fastest that have ever been in the history of time. So
yeah, and so this is one of the challenges of professional athletics in general. In the world, but the United States does a very poor job of this particularly, which is we follow, for instance, the NBA and maybe some college basketball, but like we don't really care about what's happening with the Utes until they become like the best of the best and are playing the sport professionally and everything. And that's always kind of a disappointment to me in general. Like how the sport matures over time is really an interesting and enjoyable experience.
And also, it's very interesting too. There are people who will have really good moments in their life that are not at the typical peak of what most people would say are the physical, you know, your physical peak in your fitness in your life. So like, that's why I would love to talk more about like masters who are breaking records, within, because a lot of them like did not run professionally. But now as 80, 90-year-olds, they have this longevity. And then there's some kids who just, you know, before they go through puberty, they're like freaks of nature fast too. So like, I think we should celebrate all the points and not wait for this like one time of life to celebrate really good success in the sport.
Yeah. So that's the thing I was going to get to and then kind of lost my train was other parts of the world, they have a much more highly developed age group dynamic within the sport of running. And it's more highly spectated as well as participation. And so part of that, we enjoy that and want to be able to share some of that here with you as well. So speaking of the younger age groups, Arcadia is like swiftly becoming the best moment in high school track and field. And so over the years, in the last like several, it's certainly been growing in attention, but also in accomplishment. And now what it comes down to is the assumption is that Arcadia is like the pinnacle moment of the track season outside of like the big national championships, which even then, arguably, Arcadia is more exciting at times than those. So here's what you get with Arcadia is you get these mile and 3,200 meter races, or 1,600 meter and 3,200, depends on the different things. But where like all the fastest kids from the entire United States seem to show up and race. And it was amazing this year.
I'm going to show my ignorance. Where's Arcadia?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I don't remember exactly where it is. I looked that up and then I forgot. All right, we'll find it out for you. Arcadia. Okay, as it were, while we're figuring that out, something like not the Arcadia golf course, we had in particular this year the highest concentration of top level performances ever in a single meet, right? And so what that amounted to then is for the boys 3200 meters, there's like this benchmark over time. And for the girls, there's one as well. It's a little bit different. And then this benchmark is it's 9 minutes in like the 3200. And they say, okay, so that's like the best of the best are running under 9 minutes in the 3200 for the boys. And for the girls, the best of the best under, you know, X or Y. And 69 boys did that in one meet.
Did what?
Run under 9 minutes in the 3200 meters. And for perspective, prior to this meet, the most in a single meet was 44. So it's like 50% more than had ever happened before. And the thinking here is, well, because you just keep every year you see more people doing this. And so now last year it was 44. This year it's 69. Next year it's going to be like 120 because everyone sees that and says, I want to go there next year because I want to do that too. And then they do. And it's crazy. For instance, in the invitational section, which is the fast heat, which I guess there were like 38 boys in the invitation. That is way too many. That's people.
A lot on a track.
I don't know exactly what the number was. Maybe it was two heats and that met with 38 total, but I think it was 38 in one heat. It was a lot.
That's too many.
But my point is, of those 38 in the invitational section or sections, 37 of them ran under 9 minutes.
Wow.
And so it's like, I got to be in that race because it's going to happen. It's just magic. Well, here's what happened this time in particular is you had like all these legendary high school boys. Legendary is not really an appropriate term for high school boys.
They're children.
They really do think they're legendary. But in this sense, the great achievements of this past year were scattered. There was not like one dominant force like in the past, like Sermon Birnbaum or Nico Young. And then they all showed up at once to race together. So you had Daniel Simmons, who broke the 5,000-meter high school record in indoors. You have JoJo Jordan, who won Nike Cross Nationals. You've got Drew Griffith, who won Foot Locker Cross Nationals, and then also broke the indoor 2-mile record this year. All of this stuff is this year. And then you've got the Nike Indoor National 2-mile champion, among many others. And so all these boys are in one race at the same time. That never happens. This is why Arcadia is like just this massive thing, because they're never all together in the same race like this. So that's why it was exciting. And who ended up being the triumphant, the victor of the masses? Well, this time around, it was Daniel Simmons, fresh off a high school 5,000 meter record, ran a top 10 all-time performance to win the race, out kicking Nathan Neal, which was itself quite impressive because Nathan Neal had the faster last lap, the faster kick. But he was just coming from a little bit further behind. And then together, the two of them and five other boys ran under 8:40. So for context, several years ago, 8:40 was like the national record. Seven boys just did it in one race. And then behind them, as mentioned, 62 others went under 9 minutes.
That's wild.
Wild.
On the women's side, there was nearly a national record in the girls' mile for Sadie Engelhart. It was the number two performance behind Mary Kane.
For the outdoor mile.
Yeah. It's her third victory in a row as a junior, which means that she's won every year.
She wins Arcadia every single time, which is just crazy. That's also never happened, by the way. So the comments here is, if Sadie Engelhart can pull it off and win again next year, she'd be the only person who's ever done that. Four straight. That'd be crazy.
And, you know, she's a junior. And here we are, number two performance of all time.
Wow.
Knocking on the door.
Speaking of really fast youngsters, we had to just take a quick jump across the world because we've been talking about Claudia Hollingsworth. And we've been trying to keep you informed. She is the Australian teenager who has just been mowing over all the U20 records out there. Well, she just did another one, but it was her own. So she's bested her own U20 1500 record. She ran 4:02.
Wow.
Yeah. Say that again. So she is not turning 20 in 2024. That's what that means in terms of under 20 record. So Hollingsworth, as a 4:02 1500 meter runner, is currently the number two ranked 1500 meter runner in the entire nation of all ages.
Of Australia.
In Australia. And on top of that, with her 1:58, she's also the number one ranked 800 meter runner in the entire nation of Australia as a teenager. And you see stuff like this and you're like, that is uncanny. That's incredible. Yeah. And yet it's not unheard of. You think of Jakob Ingebrigtsen. He first rose to fame when he started winning major races at the age of 16.
Yes.
So this does happen. It's just really exciting when it does. So
didn't LJ Wilson start when she was a teenager?
Yeah, what was her first world champ?
But it was very young. She's definitely a teenager.
It happens, and it's really exciting when it does. Yeah. So more on that. We'll keep following these youngsters and their amazing careers. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, we've got to talk about the roads.
U.S. 10-mile championships, which takes place at the Cherry Blossom 10-miler. On the men's side, it was a very exciting championship.
Yikes.
Should I just tell him who won to start it off? Okay. So Hillary Bohr,
won the championship, but not the race.
Yeah, the championship. Yep.
Okay, gotcha.
Championship. He is a previous podcast guest, by the way.
Second time in a row.
Yeah.
Defending champ. All right.
Yeah. He broke his own record by 15 seconds, running a time of 45:56.
All right.
First in the race was Wesley Kiptoo in 45:54. Notice how close those two times are. And then second place was Raymond Magette. 45:55.
They were tight.
And Nate Martin, who also ran under the previous record in a time of 46 flat, meaning that these gentlemen were all within 6 seconds of one another.
Wow.
Yes.
Let's dwell on that a moment. Nice work, Nate. Like
Nate Martin.
46 flat, almost American record, if not for Hillary Bohr, and almost a U.S. title, if not for Hillary Bohr.
Exactly.
Wow. Well done.
He showed up, and he was the one who started pressing, too. So props to Nate Martin for making this race go too.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Side note, if you're getting confused, Kiptoo and Magut are Kenyan.
Oh, right. That's why.
So the race, anyone can run it, but the U.S. championship part of it,
yes,
you have to be a U.S. citizen.
I said that in a very confusing way. Hillary Bohr was third overall, first for the championship. Nate Martin was fourth overall, second for the championship.
Yep.
On the women's side, I'll start with the winner of the race, who is not from the U.S., Sarah Tlengit. She repeated as the overall champion from last year.
Ugandan?
I thought she was Ethiopian.
Okay.
Am I wrong?
I think she's Ugandan, but...
Okay, she might be. Third overall was from Ethiopia. Kanesha Anui. And so let's get to the championship part of it, where Emily Durgan was second overall woman and winner for the USATF championship. And the reason this is such a big deal is that Emily Durgan is always like one of the top scoring road racing championship circuit runners. And this is her first U.S. title. She just kept showing up and then ended up winning her first title. And I guess she ran really hard all the way to this line, because behind her was Rachel Smith in second place for the championship, fourth overall, who had outkicked her at the 15K championships.
Just recently.
So Emily was saying in an interview that she needed to open up enough of a gap, and she just was running as hard as she could because she was worried that Rachel was going to come up on her and
do it again.
Do it again. So, yep, Rachel Smith in second, and then Annie Frisbee in third.
Right on. Durgan's time, by the way, was almost an American record for women-only race. That record set by Kira D'Amato in that special event back in 2020. You remember that? That was around when the pandemic stuff was like canceling all the events. We talked to Kira because that's when she like suddenly started like just running amazing performances.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, whoa, what's going on here? But since it was like pandemic overload and everything was getting canceled. It's like, Kira, you need a chance to race because you got to show what you've got here. And so they were putting together some of these, like, these obscure events that were kind of strange and private and secret and everything. Anyway, she ran the women's record 10 mile, which stands today, but Durgan only missed it by 3 seconds. That's something.
That's an exciting championship.
Well, we've got one more thing to share here. And as we like to do lately, we're bringing you a headline now for an article that is of particular interest. Shout out to Bill, by the way, listener who shared this article with us. And not because he was saying, hey, you should put this on the podcast, although maybe that was part of his motivation, I don't know. But because he said, this is interesting. Have you seen this? And it is indeed interesting. So thank you for sharing, Bill. Talking about, from Outside Magazine, a study on the effects of cold on endurance performance. And so Alex Hutchinson, as he often is, an excellent author on running topics, breaks down the study and takes a look at what it has to say and how it says it. So they took cyclists and exposed them to sustained cold to do one of a few things, and it depended on the situation. They did a few different times. And so one thing, they're trying to just lower their skin temperature, right? Which takes topical cold in some sense, sustained over time. But also another instance, they lowered their core temperature. And in some cases, the cyclists had to sit in the cold chamber, which is basically like a cold sauna, for over 2 hours to get their core temperature down as low as they wanted to, which was, they only wanted to lower it like a degree. It was a very small change. But what they actually, in some instances, they couldn't even lower it enough where they were in the cold chamber for almost 3 hours and it didn't lower all the way. So it's like, wow, you guys got some resilient heat
retention.
And some of these athletes, which is cool. Anyway, point is, that's the experience. Okay, so you got to think about this for a second. They had like gloves and earmuffs so that they didn't get like frostbite, right? And their feet were covered with some kind of blanket, so that they wouldn't get frostbite on their extremities because they're 2 hours in this cold chamber. And then as soon as they came out of the cold, they had a 5-minute warm up at like low wattage on a bike, and then they had to ride to exhaustion at VO2 max, essentially 70%, of VO2 max. Ride to exhaustion. So here's the effect now. And this is where things get crazy. Just lowering their skin. Well, and I should say, when they do the ride, they're no longer in the cold. They come out of the cold and then ride in normal conditions. So it's not like you're riding in freezing conditions also. When you just lower someone's skin temperature in this situation with this study, they saw an impact on endurance performance that reduced their time to exhaustion 30%, a 30% reduction just by making them cold at a skin level
before,
prior to riding. Yeah. So you gotta think about that for a second. Being cold lowered their performance substantially. Now get this, the core temperature situation, which granted takes quite extreme measures, 2 hours exposed to cold, another 30 to 40% reduction further. So we're talking like a guy who might ride 26, 27 minutes, saw like 7 or 8 minutes to exhaustion. That's the dramatic impact. And so this is crazy, all right? So we talk about, what kinds of things we have to be thinking about as runners, and don't be cold before you race. Don't do it. Whatever it takes to not be cold before you start the race, you should think about that.
Yeah.
They actually saw in instances here that when the athletes started, that their initial temperature actually lowered further in the beginnings of the exercise because blood starts circulating, right? And the cold blood circulates a bit. So it actually took quite a while for them to even begin to warm up. And in some instances, with like the core temperature situation, they actually never warmed up. Like rode to exhaustion and never could fully warm up. Their temperature reading stayed flat.
That's so crazy. I'm feeling really justified in how I overdress and then have to just take off some layers. I feel very justified in this. And also it reminds me, I think it was Kira D'Amato in one of her wins, or maybe it was her one of her records that she got. I remember her wearing like arm sleeves and like more than some of the other people were wearing. Do you remember?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Maybe it was.
I'm sure it happened.
It happened. But yeah, you don't want to be cold. And we have practical application for this. Wearing those throwaway layers at the start and maybe wearing them like you might need it a couple miles in the race too and then take it off. If you're doing a marathon, like, you know, consider that. Consider like wearing the hat and gloves longer than you had originally intended.
Yeah, it should be noted that there are plenty of studies on being cold and performance, and it is true that studies find that performing in the cold does not seem to have a major effect, and in some instances actually helps with endurance performance. But being cold and then performing is a huge problem. So that's the distinction we're drawing here. And it just reminds me of way back years and years ago, the first time I ever did a major road race event, I was part of a team that did the Detroit Marathon Relay. And that's one of those where, you know, you run 5 miles or 3 miles or 6 miles or something. And so
Playmakers, right?
Yeah. Yep. That's right. Back in the day. And so I was like a third or fourth leg kind of situation on the relay. And as such, spent a fair bit of time just waiting around. And the guys before, like the day before when we were talking about it, they're like, yeah, I'm heading to Goodwill right now, which is a thrift store. I'm heading to the thrift store to get some layers. I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, because we're not going to be by the start or anywhere. You're just going to have to throw them off. You're just going to have to throw them in a trash can somewhere. And I was like, oh yeah, I didn't think about that. Like all I had was like my nice warm-ups. And they're like, no, get like a sweater and a hat and like all the stuff. And it wasn't that cold. It was like 45 degrees and they were onto something. And so this was, you know, my induction into big road racing event types of experiences. And I've never forgotten that, you know, now I don't usually stock up on thrift store layers and throw them away. I just find a place to put stuff that I can get back.
Give it to the people you're with.
But the point is, keep the layers on until the last possible moment, or even, as Andy said, into the beginning of things, depending on the race and the distance and such.
So a lot of times, I just want to put this side note in, when you take off those layers, those throwaway layers, they do end up donating all of that stuff. So I just want to let you know.
Depending on the race event, sure. Yeah.
Know that, because that also could be part of your consideration as well.
Donated to the landfill.
Yeah. No.
Oh.
No.
I often wonder if that's what they are actually doing. When they say that. But we don't know. Either way, have the layers on. And don't take them off when you're going into the start corral, because you still got an hour to wait when you get into that start corral. So that's the message, and we are sticking to it. I just did it at the same time as you. But I just wanted to remind you of your homework. So take your inner voice inventory and make a list of your core value stuffs, and then take a look at the alignment. See if they're aligned, and if not, reflect on those conflicts and be ready for some serious practical advice next week.
And for those of you who are running Boston,
good luck.
It's a celebration run, so enjoy it. And also, you can be thinking about some of those things you want to tell yourself. Plan those now and give yourself some inner coaching.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.